season 5 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 3rd of July, and in this episode we're going to review the Humble Indie Bundle and listen to Tony interview Michael Hall about Download for Ubuntu. We will of course go over the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, tomorrow's technology today, command line love, and an update on our competition. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the IRC channel. I'm Mark, and with me tonight is Alan.
Hello.
And, no.
My cat.
Just Alan.
Yes.
So we're actually in Studio B this week, I believe.
Yes, which is actually the studio we recorded the very first episode in.
Oh, before my time.
Yes, yes. Things have moved on, though, and we've now got a Studio A somehow.
So this was, in fact, Studio A-1.
Yeah, I'm not
one.
Quite sure how the old naming system... I blame Tony.
Yeah. So what have you been up to in the past couple of weeks, Alan?
Well, we mentioned there's an app developer competition last time.
Oh, yes.
And I thought I'd enter. I thought it'd be good fun to enter the competition, or showdown, I think it's called, not a competition.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing Unity Lens.
And what does your lens do, or is that top secret until the competition's over?
Well, I guess it's not really top secret. It searches online stores for products.
Oh, well, that's quite good.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that. So much as the Music Lens searches for music online and locally,
yeah,
and the Video Lens searches for video online, this one searches for anything online. Like
sort of like Amazon, eBay sort of
exactly.
thing, Play.com.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and it works, kind of. We need to add a few features in, and I'm not sure... we'll get it finished for the showdown. But actually, it's been a really useful learning exercise for me, just learning how lenses work and how they fit together and actually how easy they are to make. So, yeah,
well,
good
cool.
fun. Yeah, good fun. How about yourself? What have you been up to?
In an unexpected turn of events, I've been doing ASP.NET development at work for the past couple of weeks, which has been a slightly unusual experience for me, learning C# and... the strange ways in which ASP.NET work. But,
right. Does that mean you've been using a Windows development machine?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Visual Studio. Oh, I feel so dirty.
I hear people rave about that as a development environment and wonder why there isn't something as good on Linux.
It does. Okay, it has a very good auto-completion feature.
Wow.
So if you don't really know how to write code, it's really, really easy to write code.
Does it have a little paperclip that pops up and says, I see you're trying to write an ASP website?
It does do some annoying thing, but then, a lot of IDEs have this factor in which you save a file and it'll decide that it's just going to churn for about 3 minutes, probably while it indexes
updates
the code.
And stuff,
yeah, I mean, Eclipse has the same problem, and this is why I use Vim.
I'm sure there's a version of Vim for Windows you could...
There is, but then if I'm doing .NET development, I might as well be doing it in... I don't know. It does... I mean, there's also a few sort of... I don't know. It's a very different concept to working with PHP like I'm used to. It's like someone's taken sort of the Visual Basic method of making applications and shoehorned it onto the web. So it's sort of... Rather than PHP just sort of works with the web, takes a request and processes it and spits something out.
So it's
ASP sort of works in spite of it.
So it's a bit like PHP, a bit like Visual Basic, so a double whammy of pain. With that, let's get on with the show.
That was a very quick sting.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm not Tony. I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the length of the stings. Sorry.
Right, okay, now... a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned the Humble Indie Bundle, number 5,
yes,
which ran recently. For those listeners who don't know, the Humble Indie Bundle is an occasional offer that a load of game developers are brought together by Humble Bundle Inc., who agree to release their games cross-platform and DRM-free under a pay-what-you-want sort of deal.
Right. It's gone a number of times now.
Yes, well, this is the 5th Humble Indie Bundle, and there was another one which was all games from a particular developer, so this was probably the 6th one.
I think it's even more than that, because
really?
There's been a couple of Android bundles.
Ah,
and
yes.
Yeah, the Frozen Bundle or whatever
was the other one, yeah.
Yeah.
But this time, it was a bit of a special bundle, because for the first time, All of the games which are in the Humble Indie Bundle were also available through the Ubuntu Software Center, and you could redeem your bundle in the Software Center.
Yes. Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, actually. I don't think it wasn't announced before the bundle came out. It was just, oh, and by the way, you can also get it in the Ubuntu App Store.
But yeah, even though the bundle offer is over, so you can't get it on the pay what you want anymore, all the games are still available to buy in the Ubuntu Software Center.
Right.
So we thought it might be good to do a little review of them.
Yes.
As we both bought the bundle ourselves.
Yes.
And we both like games, and Tony's not here to tell us not to.
Okay, so what do you... I'm assuming you play them all on Linux.
Yes.
Right. Same here. But... I found some of the games didn't work particularly well on my machines because most of my machines are Intel based. So
right.
Some of them are quite meaty. They're they're not like, you know, Tux Racer or something. Mm.
They are. A couple of them particularly are proper full on 3D
monsters.
I have an ATI graphics card which is fairly beefy, so it can handle, you know, some good games quite well.
Okay.
So I didn't really have a lot of trouble with that. If we just talk about some of the games and what they're like, we can get into the good bits and the bad bits as we go through. Psychonauts was the first one I played.
Right. I found that a little bit freaky, to be honest.
It is a bit of an odd game. It sort of, at initial glance, it looks a bit like a sort of Nickelodeon cartoon.
Yes.
But when you start playing it, it's got a lot more of a sort of... It's not got such a kiddie feel as it does in appearance. But on the other hand, it does have some brilliant characters and some hilarious dialogue.
And for those who are not aware, what kind of game is it?
It's sort of a sort of action-adventure 3D platformer. It's the kind of game which, I suppose, it put me in mind of something like Crash Bandicoot in terms of the actual structure of the game. You've got a sort of hub world where you go...
It feels like a console game.
Yeah, that's it. It really does. And it feels like a proper professional console game. I mean, I'm not saying that because it's made by amateurs. It's made by a company called Double Fine Productions, who... Right.
They've got a long history.
They've got a long history. They used to work for LucasArts and worked on the Monkey Island games and things like that.
Yes.
So, you know, these guys know their stuff.
They're the same guys who've made a boatload of money on Kickstarter
to do
the next game.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I mean, yeah, so it's a proper professional game. And it's, I mean, it's a lot of fun to play. It's quite a big game as well. And
so did it hold you for a long period of time in one sitting, or was it one of those ones where you have to keep going back to it?
I think I've probably played probably two or three sittings of, you know, a couple of hours each. Once you get stuck in, you want to keep playing, and
right.
You know, there's a lot to do, a lot to find. You know, there's items to collect and things to buy, and obviously challenges to beat, which is the main object of the game, to progress through the storyline.
Right.
And it's got a decent storyline as well. It's not just, you know, doing a level for the sake of doing a level. It's, you know, actually properly scripted and thought out and all voice acted really well, and it's, you know, really well worth the play.
And how did it perform on your system?
It performed pretty well. I had a play around with the resolutions. One thing I found while playing this, in fact I found in the past playing games, is that dual screening on Linux and playing games is a bit of an experience. Yeah. It's a bit hit and miss. Psychonauts, however, I did manage to get full dual screen resolution playing with a very little bit of lag here and there.
Okay, so let's move on to what's the next game?
Super Brothers. Well, the full title of the game is Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP. I'm going to call it Swords and Sorcery.
Okay.
Because that's a very big mouthful to say.
So what's Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery?
Well, the reason it's got EP at the end is because it's all based around music. So it's not a musical game in the same way that Guitar Hero is a musical game. It's
more
an
like
adventure game.
Bit Trip Runner, where the music changes in the game?
It's sort of a music appreciation experience. That's the best way I can describe it. It's an adventure game which is presented a bit sort of like King's Quest.
Okay.
So you're in a sort of medieval town. It's all pixelated graphics, but quite pleasingly put together.
Right.
So, you know, the background has quite a lot of detail, even though the characters are just blocky little things.
Right.
But throughout the game, there's sort of, you know, very well composed music, very atmospheric music, and it's sort of designed each session. It presents you to the game in sessions, so it's not expecting you to sit down in one long go and play through the whole thing. It sort of breaks it up for you, and each session is sort of based around a sort of series of little bits of music that set the scene for what you're doing.
And am I right in saying the music for some of these games you have to download separately? Is that the
No, you don't have to. No, part of the bundle deal was that you also get the game, you get the music in FLAC format. In fact, I think you got that for all of the games in the bundle. You got the soundtracks as well. So because, you know, some of the games do have really good soundtracks, Bastion as well, which we'll come on to later, has some really good soundtracks. So they also released those as downloads as part of the bundle.
So did this Swords and Sorcery leave you coming back for more? Is it something you'd play again? Or?
I wouldn't say that it made me want to, you know, really sit and play it to death. But it's right. A nice experience. It's a different experience. It's not your classical gaming experience. It's not like something which you have to try hard to beat, but it's something that's nice to enjoy.
You said it was like King's Quest. Is it like King's Quest in the like the fun aspect of it and the hidden things you've got to try and find to click on?
There's sort of, you know, some humor in the dialogue and it's not so much of the sort of hidden puzzles and things like that.
Right.
But yeah, it's got, you know, interaction with characters and funny bits.
Cool. What's the next one? Limbo.
Now you can talk about Limbo.
Limbo's the one that I've played the most.
Yeah.
So Limbo is it's set in a kind of dream world, and it's two-dimensional left and right scroller with jumping and ladders and, you know, and pushing objects in order to overcome obstacles. It's two-dimensional, but it's got a like three-dimensional parallax to it. So like the background moves in a really nice way, but it's really well lit and it's quite dark. But it's really atmospheric.
Yeah.
And so you're just this one guy, and there's no the way the character's drawn is you can really tell the way he's walking, and the character comes across really well, but all you can see is two dots for his eyes that blink now and then. I really enjoyed this. I found myself coming back to it over and over again because it was one of those things you could just jump into and carry on where you left off. I'd get a bit frustrated now and then. Because,
there are some really tricky bits to it.
Yeah, and like, you know, early on in the game you walk along and suddenly you get mashed by a bear trap.
It's really grisly as well.
Yeah.
For considering it's basically all just black and white, it's really sort of gory. Dark. Whenever you die in a horrible way.
Yeah. Yeah, either getting mashed by a rotating blade or something dropped on you. Or
impaled by a giant spider.
But it's good fun.
Yeah, and, no, it's brilliant
the
fun.
The graphics are, even though it's all pretty much monochrome, with little hints of light here and there, it's a really good game. I thoroughly enjoy Limbo. And it's one of the main reason I played it a lot was because it was one of the only games that worked well on my Intel graphics.
Well, interestingly, this game was a bit controversial for its inclusion in the bundle, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Because, the big thing is that the games work on Mac, Windows, and Linux, but the reason this works on Linux is because it's running through Wine.
Right, they bundle in Codeweavers.
Crossover. Yeah, it's a specially crafted bottle by Codeweavers to make it run, basically.
Right, and some people got a little bit upset. We've reported on this before because it was not a native, in inverted commas, game.
But I don't see why it matters, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same side. I don't really care. So long as there's more games and I can play them on my Linux system, I don't really care.
If they said, you know, these are all open source native Linux games, except this one's through Wine and it's proprietary, then I'd say, oh, wait a minute. But, you know, they're all proprietary games, so what's the actual difference whether it's running through Wine or not, as long as it plays, as long as it's supported?
Yeah, underneath it all, it's a bundle of libraries that enable, like, sound, video, you know, input, output, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's not a problem. So, what else have we got?
Lone Survivor. Did you play that at all?
No.
Lone Survivor, well...
Oh, yes, I did. That's the zombie kind of...
Yes.
Looking...
Yes. Now, if people had trouble with Limbo using Wine, I'm really surprised they didn't have trouble with Lone Survivor, because Lone Survivor is a Flash game.
Oh!
And it runs in a little Flash player window on your desktop.
Oh, mine didn't.
Oh,
Is this the one where the guy's in a bed and he hides against the wall?
Yes.
No, no, that went full screen on my machine.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
See, it didn't go full screen on mine. I couldn't get it to. It was...
And interestingly, when it was full screen, I thought, do you know what? I like the pixelated style. It's got that kind of low-res style. And it reminded me, actually, of some old Spectrum games that I used to play.
I was going
to
say, it reminded me of playing a SNES emulator.
Yes, with the scan lines.
Yes.
It reminded me of Turn-An-Og, Dunderac, and Heavy on the Magic, which are three old games from...
before my time.
Yeah, probably before you were born, little lad. But they were all the same kind of format, walking left and right, and then you turn, and it's two-dimensional. But
That's one thing I found a bit hard to manage with the game, is that it's set in a 3D world, but everything's presented on a 2D plane.
Like a lot of some of the more recent Mario games.
Yes.
Do the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Where you walk through a door and then it rotates.
And then it rotates, except it's not always clear that it's rotating.
Yes.
You have to keep on checking your map to work out which direction you're actually walking in.
Yeah.
It's quite easy to get lost that way.
You end up walking completely the wrong direction and not realize it. Yeah. Mm. It's got some nice... I like the fact that you can do the hiding against the wall.
Yeah, because basically the idea of the game is it's a sort of a survival horror. You've escaped from the zombie-infested city, basically. And you can do it either by shooting your way out or sneaking your way out are essentially your choices. So a bit like Resident Evil, you can choose to avoid the zombies and conserve your ammo or shoot everything and hope that you don't run out.
Yeah, I was more for not managing to hide very well and getting killed by them.
Yeah, it's quite difficult. And it's quite confusing and a bit on the disturbing side, like working out what's going on at the start.
I quite liked it, but I think what detracted for me was not the fact it's Flash and not the fact that it was a bit difficult, but actually the whole low res thing kind of was a bit too much. It felt like I was playing a game in an emulator.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, there's some, you know, merit in that, and I do play games in emulators.
But there's a lot of games I'd rather play in an emulator.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, maybe if you're a diehard survival horror fan, it's definitely worth a look.
Yeah, totally.
But then again, if you're a diehard survival horror fan, our next game is
which one's this? Oh, Amnesia.
Blows the rest away.
No, I didn't play this one, I don't.
Right.
Think.
Amnesia is a proper first person 3D survival horror game, but it's a completely different idea. You don't have guns, you don't have any sort of weaponry really. You're basically in a mansion or a castle or something. You've lost your memory.
Oh, that old story.
Yeah, and you've got a note to yourself saying you have to find a guy and kill him.
Ah, excellent.
But the game's mechanics are properly geared to getting you scared and really freaking you out. So the way the game works is you have two sort of meters. You have your health and you have your sanity. So if your health goes, you die. If your sanity goes, you start to hallucinate both visually and audibly.
Oh,
so you start to hear things which there's nothing in the game to cause them. Your vision starts to go. But what causes you to go insane is being in the dark.
Okay.
So which means you have to find light sources and keep stuff alight.
Do you get like candles, flashlights?
You have a lamp. And you have tinder boxes to light lamps, but you've got limited supply.
Right.
So you've got to ration those.
And is the whole thing set inside this castle?
Inside this castle.
You don't go outside the castle, it's just a very large castle with many rooms.
As far as I played, no. I think you sort of work your way down into the dungeons of the castle.
And are there other characters that you interact with at all?
None that I found. There are things.
Okay.
Creatures
without giving away too much.
Well, then, I haven't really seen what they are.
Okay.
You just see things.
Sure, you weren't hallucinating.
You have to. Well, this is the thing. You see things, and you have to avoid them somehow. You have no way of fighting them, so you have to hide. But the only way to hide is to go in the dark. And if you go in the dark, you start to go insane
and start seeing more things.
That's
a fantastic game concept. I do like that.
To be honest, I played my first sitting. I played as the manual recommends in the dark, headphones on, by myself. Played for about 2 hours. Went back the next day. Tried to play in the light. Couldn't do it.
Really?
Yeah. It's the stress of knowing how it all works and thinking, oh, I can't go in there because I don't have any way of keeping in the light.
It sounds very immersive.
It is. It's really once you start hearing things, you're just gone. You're there, and it's
excellent.
It's amazing.
And the last one was Bastion.
Now, Bastion is a game like no other I've ever played. It's half hack and slash RPG, but half interactive fiction.
Oh.
So you've got this guy with a really, really good narrator voice doing a voiceover for the whole thing.
This is the isometric 3D where the world pops up in front of you
exactly.
and you're walking along.
So it's
right.
Yeah, so you view it from an isometric sort of view above you,
mm-hmm.
And you've got weapons to hack up enemies and stuff and find power-ups and whatever. Right. The graphics are lovely. The backgrounds are sort of got a hand-painted thing. The music is brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's got this narration which goes throughout the whole game. Everything you do, the narrator has something to say, as well as telling the story in between the levels. So you fall off the edge and he'll say something, but he won't say, I fell off the edge. He'll like work it into the narrative like he's telling the story, and that's just what happened at that point.
Right.
And it's really well put together, really immersive. That's the only one so far which I've played. Once I started playing it, I couldn't stop.
Yeah, that's I only played it for a short while, but I did find it. First of all, the voice was very annoying, and then after a while, I kind of got used to it. And found, okay, this is part of the game. It's not just some dude shouting in my ear telling me that I suck.
But the other thing about the mechanics of the game is because of the way the power up system works, you can actually make the game harder or easier just to suit you. So you can give yourself bonuses, but you can also give yourself penalties as you go through. So if you find it's getting too easy, just make the enemy stronger just as you're going.
Cool. So it's a good selection of games, really.
Yeah.
And would you recommend people buy anything now the Humble Bundle's over and you can't get them for the dirt cheap price you have to pay full price, which still isn't a ridiculous amount of money?
No.
Which ones would you recommend of those that people went out and bought?
I would definitely say Bastion, without a doubt. If you can cope with it, I'd say Amnesia. and I'd probably say Limbo as well. Psychonauts, I'd probably give Psychonauts a go. I don't know how much it is. I'd pay for Psychonauts, but I'm not sure how much I'd pay.
Right.
But it is, if you like that sort of game, it's really fun.
Excellent. Awesome. So, yes, you can still get those games. They're all in the Ubuntu Software Center.
Yep.
Go and have a play.
Time for the news. And HP has released WebOS Community Edition, the open source version of its Linux-based mobile operating system. The initial release is aimed at owners of the discontinued HP TouchPad.
Is actually this time? We've heard this a lot. Is it actually?
No, they've actually
released. All you can get.
I imagine so.
Right. We've seen the news of this quite a lot, and then
it sounds like there is something which you can do something with, and people are playing with it.
Well, that's good to see. I didn't mention in the intro, I bought a tablet recently, and I'd be interested in trying it out on that. It's a hackable device.
That would be interesting.
Google announced basically everything at their recent I/O summit. Nexus 7, Nexus Q, Glass, movies, TV shows in the Play Store, they've basically got everything.
Yeah. The new version of Android, which is...
Jelly Bean,
which they did a high-speed camera comparison to the responsiveness between 4.0 and 4.1 to show the difference.
Is it markedly different?
Apparently it's like... there's been a lot of criticism that it doesn't sort of snap like the iPad interface does in response to your gestures, and this is supposed to fix it. Yeah. Nexus 7 is interesting because this is going to be running the new Android Jelly Bean, and it's available for pre-order now, and I pre-ordered one. Because, it's a pretty well-specced tablet for not so much money.
£200 over here for the 16 gig.
For the 16 gig version.
£60 for the.
And it's got quad core Tegra processor and something like a 12 core GPU. I'm not sure why you need 12 cores and GPU, but it's going to be good for games, or we'll know that much. Adobe has announced that Flash will no longer be supported on the new 4.1 release of Android, nor future versions of the mobile OS, with new installs being disabled as of the 15th of August.
Do we care?
Um, I've never successfully used Flash on Android. I've never needed to. I don't like using Flash on the PC.
Yeah, having had an iPad where Flash wasn't available, it was very rare that I ever went anywhere that needed it. Moving on. Free Software Foundation has published a white paper containing recommendations for free software distributions considering secure boot. The paper discusses the relative pros and cons of Fedora and Ubuntu's approaches, stating clearly that Grub2's GPL version 3 license is not at odds with security, and advises against any solution which relies on trust being placed in Microsoft as a silent organization.
it's quite an interesting and constructive output of the Free Software Foundation. They do tend to be a bit hard line at times, especially with some of their campaigns, but this seems a bit more considered and pragmatic about, you know, they'd say that look at Fedora's choice that they've made and say, well, you know, these are the good points about it and they're valid good points, but on the other hand, it means that you have to trust Microsoft, which they're never going to do.
Yes. Well, we could all buy the same laptop that Richard Stallman has, the Lilu or whatever it's called.
No, you can't, because you can't buy them anymore.
Well, can you not?
No.
someone apparently needs to make devices that
with open BIOS and things like that.
Apparently that would make everything happen. Gamers using Wine to play Blizzard's recently released Diablo 3 have complained that they've been banned from the game for using unapproved third-party software. Blizzard responded to the claim after an investigation of the alleged unjust bans, stating that playing the game on Linux, although not officially supported, will get you banned. Will not get you banned, yes. Slight change in tone. cheating will.
So yeah, they basically said that they've investigated all the reported cases where people have been banned for playing Wine and found that there was a good reason for them being banned, which wasn't them using Wine.
Right. And so is this good that they've come out and said, you know, it's okay, you can use Wine?
Yeah, I think that's quite good. Because, I mean, Codeweavers basically released on the day of release a supported version of Crossover, which would run Diablo 3, because they knew there would be a lot of demand for it. And it's quite good, that Blizzard are actually saying, yeah, we know people are doing this, and we'd not bother by it at all.
Yeah, maybe that opens the door for more developers to have, their games out online, and users will be a bit more confident that Wine's
absolutely
perfectly fine platform to play games under, like Limbo, for example. Has no problem whatsoever. Is that all the news for today?
That's all the news.
What about events?
We have the only event worth knowing about.
Well, there is only one event this year.
Yes. It's, of course, Og Camp. And it's happening on the 17th and 18th, 18th and 19th. Which one is the Saturday and Sunday?
Yes, 18th
and
19th.
18th and 19th of August in Liverpool at Liverpool John Moore University. And if you want to come, book your hotel now, because we have a really good deal on the hotel. That expires on the 7th of July. So if you want to book the official hotel, which is the Britannia Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool City Centre, it's 5 minutes from Liverpool Lime Street and 5 minutes from the venue. So it's in a brilliant location, and we're all going to be there, and the social events will be there. There's details on the website of how to book, but if you're going to book before the 7th of July, or you'll miss out on the cheap rate.
Right. Or find other alternative accommodation.
Yes.
Excellent. I'm not doing this again, ever.
No? You sure?
Well, maybe once.
Welcome to Tomorrow's Technology Today. I'm Deirdre Morris Oxford. Good day to all our listeners, wherever you are around the British Empire, or indeed Little Hempton. That, dear listener, is the sound of my co-host, Mr. Douglas Austin Cambridge, in Whatever Are You Wearing, Douglas?
Your powers are weak, old girl. I am the master now.
Only the master of silly helmets, Douglas. Take it off.
Ah. That's better.
What is this black rubber monstrosity?
You mean the electrically heated boiler suit that I'm wearing this very minute?
Yes, it's hideous.
It's the Royal Navy's latest protective suit, Deirdre, for safely exploring hazardous environments. Well, I ask you, what's wrong with a decent set of tweeds?
You sound a little out of breath, Douglas.
Yes, for two reasons, Deirdre. For one thing, the thermostat doesn't seem to be working. What does the temperature gauge read?
85 degrees Fahrenheit, or 29.44 degrees Celsius.
Let's not have any of those continental units of measure here, Deirdre. Remember, we're British.
I'll remind you when you're recovering from heat stroke, Douglas. So, what provides the suit's heating energy?
A lead acid accumulator in this backpack, weighing a mere 77 pounds.
Tell me, Douglas, is the material proof against corrosion?
I don't think so, Deirdre. Why do you ask?
Because, Douglas, there's a large smoking hole in the seat of your...
Yes, Deirdre?
I don't like to say on the wireless, Douglas.
Come along, you silly sausage. This is the 20th century.
There's a large smoking hole in the seat of your trouser area, Douglas. You appear to be leaking battery acid.
What? Get this off me! Get it off! I'm burning! Help!
That's all from tomorrow's Technology Today. Toodle pip and God save the king.
I'm burning! I'm burning! Help! Help!
And now it's time for some command line love.
Oh, you say it so sweetly, Mark.
Oh, thank you.
What have we got this week?
I was working on a web server over SSH, and there was a lot of stuff on it, and it was taking up too much space. Now, usually when this happens...
Delete it all.
RMRF dash is today's command line love. No. Don't do that. So... Normally on my desktop, if that happens, I run Disk Usage Analyzer, which gives you a nice graphical representation of
Baobab.
Baobab, yes. Which, great name.
Sorry, I just love saying it.
Yeah. which shows you, what folders are using how much space. So I need something like this for the command line so I could work out which folders had all the big files in and therefore I could look at what I could delete. So I found this command which uses... DU, which is disk usage, which shows you how much space stuff under the current directory is using, and then pipes it through sort and head to give you the largest 20 folder, largest 20 subdirectories of the current directory and how big they are.
Oh, that's super.
Yes, it's really handy. And then you can go, you can do other commands like LSLH to then see all of the files in the big folder and how big they are.
I frequently have this problem on my VPS. It fills up with stuff. I copy stuff up to it for sharing with people and, like copies of UUPC and ISO images and, stuff like that. And it starts filling up and I get a notification that the disk's filling up and then I just panic a little bit and think, I need to get rid of some stuff. And
yeah.
Usually what I do is use Baobab. And
over SSH
and point it at the server and just let it remotely scan. And then I just quite like the like round pie graph.
Unfortunately, I was in a situation where I was remotely logged into a Windows machine and then SSHing from that into the server. So I didn't have the luxury of doing that.
Unlucky.
Yes.
So that's today's command line love.
On the line now, we've got Michael Hall from Canonical. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So, can you tell us what you do for Canonical, please?
I am the upstream liaison on the community team, so it's my job to make sure that we're working with both our upstreams and app developers for whom we are the upstream.
Ah, so we've had George and Jono on the show before. You work with them?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you're one of the horsemen of the apocalypse or something, I think.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So we've got you on today to talk a bit about download for Ubuntu. So can you tell us what that's about, please?
This is a new campaign that we've started to highlight the fact that a lot of these applications are available already in the software center in Ubuntu. So when somebody, finds out about a new application and goes to their website, we want them to be able to see that it's available for them to download through the traditional method of getting software in Ubuntu, that they don't have to get an upstream tarball or something and install it themselves. So it's really just to highlight the fact that so much is already available to the user.
Okay, so if I am the author of a piece of software that's packaged in Ubuntu, and maybe I also have a Windows version for download from my website, what do I need to do to get the download for Ubuntu thing going on my website?
So all you really need is a button with a link to our apps.ubuntu.com portal. And we provide the HTML snippets on the wiki for adding those buttons.
Okay, and that will link to a web portal that somebody can use to download the application?
Yes, it'll show what versions of Ubuntu the application's available for. It'll give a description and screenshots. It'll also display the ratings and reviews that Ubuntu users have given the application.
Okay, so is it really just as simple as a graphic with a link to the web portal? Obviously, you've got to get your application into Ubuntu in the first place.
Yes, you have to have the application in there already, but once it is, then all you need to do is just add a couple lines of HTML to your website.
Okay. What about people who haven't got their applications in the Ubuntu repositories yet?
Well, we have several methods that'll let them do that, either through the traditional method of getting it into our main archives or Debian's archives, or we have a developer portal now where they can submit their application directly for inclusion, and that supports both open source and commercial applications.
Okay. So are you really thinking this is suitable for mainly sort of open source, community maintained packages, or is there a good commercial ecosystem around it as well?
The campaign that we're doing right now is targeting existing applications that we have. So it's mostly open source at the moment, but there's no reason that commercial applications couldn't include it also.
Okay. I guess.
So for example, we have Skype on our list that we're trying to get to include the button.
Okay, right. So that presumably would also increase the exposure for Ubuntu if people are going to the Skype website.
Yeah.
So it works both ways, I guess.
Yeah, it helps everybody. That was one of the things that I mentioned in my blog, is that it really goes both ways. It helps Ubuntu, but it also helps the upstream.
Yeah, okay. So obviously at the moment people aren't used to finding Ubuntu download buttons everywhere on the web. If you go to a website that happens to have a download for a Ubuntu or another Linux distro, it'll be a .deb or a .rpm.
Right.
Is that something that you considered when you were looking at this scheme? Because it's a potential route for confusion if you've already got a proliferation of download options for Linux and you're adding another way to download a package.
Well, it's more than just another way to download the package, because it gives a lot of exposure to the user and the upstream both. When you go to the application portal, the user gets to see more information about the app. He gets to see what other Ubuntu users think of it before he actually downloads the dev and install. So it's much less of a mystery at that point to him. And for the upstream app author, it's good because now his users know, you know, there's ratings and reviews that you can fill out. You can give the app a good rating when you're happy with it. There's links for advertising it on Facebook and Google+ and Twitter.
Oh, okay. So if you are currently maintaining your own application packages, your .debs or .rpms, you have complete control over what goes in those. But I guess if you're using the version that's in the repositories, the Ubuntu repositories, you don't necessarily, as a developer, have control over those packages. Do you think that will be a problem for people, or will it not be something they'll worry about?
Even if they don't technically have direct control over it, we don't really change much. If we change anything, it's just to make it work better with Ubuntu.
Okay. There haven't been any sort of people who've found that an issue with their packages at the moment.
Right.
Okay. And I guess there is the process where people can interact with packages and improve, you know, file bugs or whatever, and even commit changes back to their upstream packages and have those filtered down into Ubuntu.
Yes, and like I said, we try not to carry many changes. It's a lot of work on our end to carry changes.
Yes, of course, yes.
So we really do the best that we can to get everything included in upstream that we have to change.
What about applications that have a very rapid development cycle? It seems that there are quite a few where They use things like PPAs or other methods of distributing their application very quickly. Will that be possible to integrate with something like the Download for Ubuntu scheme?
Yeah, there are two options right now. They go through the developer portal to submit their application, then they can submit updated versions anytime they want. If they're included in the main archive, say we import it from Debian, then they can go through the backports process where they just have to propose the newest version of their application to go into the stable version of Ubuntu. And there's a quality assurance step that it goes through to make sure that it's going to be compatible with all the other packages in the stable version.
Excellent. I was just going to ask about, you know, is there any kind of quality control around those packages that are being linked to? And it sounds like there is a process there.
Yes, and we're currently looking at other ways to improve this, make it easier for application developers to directly manage their versions that they have in Ubuntu.
Oh, okay. What sort of things would that involve?
We're at the very early stages right now, so we're looking at the technical implications, the security implications of turning over more control over the packages directly to the developers.
Right, and would that be a sort of a distributed version control type thing using existing infrastructure like Launchpad or some other platform, or have you not really considered that?
We haven't started setting out actual implementation details yet. Okay. Right now, it's very high level. It's, you know, what are the implications of giving this control to somebody outside of Ubuntu?
Okay. You mentioned that you were looking at trying to get Skype to put this link on their website. Have you had any other early adopters that are worth particularly highlighting, or anybody, any application providers giving you any feedback about it?
We've got, looks like about a dozen applications that have included it so far. I know that our first ones were Shutter and Super Tux Cart.
Ah, right. Everybody loves a bit of Super Tux Cart, so that's good to hear that they're on board.
We've had several, and if you go to the wiki, it's wiki.ubuntu.com/softwarecenter/app-promotion. We have a section there of upstreams that have already included it.
Okay. Do you need people to let you know when they've done this?
We just ask that they update the wiki when they're doing it.
Okay.
That way everybody knows who's contacted who.
Right, okay. There's no formal approval process other than that, though?
No. It's very community-centric. So if you have the initiative, go ahead and do it.
Excellent. One of the reasons for doing this is to increase the sort of exposure of Ubuntu and vice versa, increase the exposure of the applications. Other than the general kind of proliferation of Ubuntu and getting more and more people to use it, is there a particular reason for wanting people to know about the ecosystem that is underneath Ubuntu and the range of applications? Is there a kind of a hearts and minds thing going on there?
Really, we just want people to know that these apps are available to them already. One of the things that especially new users have a hard time understanding is that they don't have to go out to the internet and download installers when they're in Ubuntu, that most of everything that they're going to want is already available in the Software Center for them to download.
Because that's one of the things that's very different about Ubuntu and its software model from Windows users, who are very used to downloading an .exe file from the internet and installing it, and then having to go back manually to look for updates or have maybe a pop-up alert to tell them there's an update for a particular application.
Right. So it's really to help kind of that educational process for new users.
Okay, so it kind of bridges that gap between them being used to going to the manufacturer's website and them actually being able to get the software through the Ubuntu repositories themselves.
Right.
And presumably once they've installed through the repositories, they get all the necessary security updates or anything that might be released by Ubuntu automatically.
Exactly. It also highlights all of the other applications that are in the Software Center. Once somebody learns about the Software Center and everything that's in it, they'll keep going back there and looking for, you know, applications whenever a need arises.
Yes, and the apps portal itself, the web portal, is particularly nice as well. Obviously, you've got the ability to browse that even when you're not using an Ubuntu machine.
Mm-hmm. Which is another reason we point to that. We didn't want these links to go to somewhere that would only work if you only have Ubuntu.
Yes, as opposed to like something like an iTunes link or whatever that requires you to have a specific piece of software available to you.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're from the community team. Is there anything that the community can do to get involved with Download for Ubuntu?
In both my blog and Jono's, we link to this wiki page, and that's really where all the action's happening. There's instructions there for what to do. We provided snippets for like the top 50 applications that we had in the Software Center based on ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very generic, so if somebody wants to target an application that's not in this list, it's easy enough for them to just change it. There's just one place where there's a package name that needs to be changed.
Is it worth community members who want to see this link on particular software websites reaching out to their friends or their contacts on those websites and sort of saying, hey, it would be really good if you put this link on there. You've already got a version that's packaged in Ubuntu. Why not?
Yeah, in a lot of instances, it was people that already had contacts with these upstreams or were involved with the upstream. In other cases, it's just straight, you know, like cold calling. They'll say, hey, I use this app. I like this app. You should put this button on your website. It'll help people.
Okay, that seems to make sense. So is there anything else you want to cover about Download for Ubuntu?
Just to encourage people to go to the wiki, and if you have an app in mind that's not on our list, just go ahead and add it and reach out to the upstream.
Cool. Is there anything else that you're currently working on that you want to let our listeners know about?
The other thing I'm currently working on is we have our app developer showdown contest.
Okay,
yeah. Last week. Have you talked to anybody about that yet?
I think we mentioned it was happening and that there's a prize, but Alan is going to try and enter it, so he was he was trying not to tell people what his idea was. But go on, he's not here, so you can spill the beans.
Okay, so the basics of the competition are you have 3 weeks to create an app from start to your submission. It's got to be for Ubuntu. We're encouraging the use of Qwikly, but that's not a requirement. The more you can integrate with Ubuntu and with Unity, the better your chances will be.
Okay.
And we've got 6 prizes lined up. The first prize will get a System 76 laptop and a Nokia N9 phone. The second place will get another laptop, not the same model, but a different model, and also one of those phones. And then the third place will get just the N9 phone. And those 3 will be chosen by a panel of judges that we have. After all of the submissions come in and they get into the Software Center, after a short period of time, we're going to go and look at the users' ratings and reviews in the Software Center itself. And then the top 3 rated applications that hadn't already won a prize will also get an N9 phone.
Oh, okay, so the first selection of winners is going to be on the basis of the judges, but there'll also be some additional prizes for the most popular user ratings.
Right, and then anybody who submits anything will be getting a Ubuntu t-shirt as well.
Oh, right, okay, so it's even as long as it meets those minimum criteria of you know, being for Ubuntu and working, I guess.
Right.
Hello World is not going to be enough to get you a t-shirt.
Right.
Oh, that's a shame.
That's
about all I can manage, unfortunately. So where can people find out more about the that developer competition?
If you go to developer.ubuntu.com/showdown, it has all of the information and rules and everything.
Sorry.
Monday and Tuesday of this week, we held a series of like 10 online sessions on Google Hangout, going over different material that people would need to know if they're entering the contest, going over different ways of building your applications with Qwikly and Glade, and over the different APIs that Ubuntu and Unity provide. And we're going to be doing the same thing next week also.
So
there'll be a link to those workshops on the website I just mentioned.
Excellent. Okay, that's great. So hopefully people will be able to get involved and come up with some nice, interesting ideas, and we can all benefit from some extra cool software going into Ubuntu.
I think we're certainly going to see some interesting things come out of
this. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us this evening, Michael, and we shall hope to speak to you soon.
All right, thank you.
It's time for the bit about Ubuntu Ecosphere, Gerald.
Yeah, that one.
Yes.
Wow.
the sugar high from the cake is now kicking in.
Joe Shields has blogged about Mono's sunrise in the games industry.
Yeah, it's an interesting article. Joe's a maintainer of the Mono stack in Debian and Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
He has some interesting things to point out about the fact that Mono is used quite heavily underneath the covers in a lot of cross-platform games.
Interestingly enough, Bastion is written in Mono.
Ah, does it use the Unity 3D engine?
I don't know.
But if it does, that's probably the reason why. But apparently that helps to make very, very cross-platform games, as in not just Windows, Linux, Mac, but also Android, iOS, Xbox.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's worth a read. It's quite interesting. And he's also started making a couple of videos about how to get started with something called Mono Game, which is a set of libraries.
Like Pygame, but for Mono.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting.
Worth a look. The Ubuntu Manual Project has released its 12.04 edition, which is good news.
Yes, absolutely. They're keeping up with the releases.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not far off. I mean, given their team is a lot smaller than it was when they first started back in like 10.10 or whenever it was, it's admirable that they've managed to crank out a release not that long after 12.04 came out, and within the five-year life cycle of 12.04.
That's the important bit, while people still might need a manual.
Exactly.
The kernel manual team is looking for users to test the 12.10 kernel on 12.04 with a view to maintaining backwards compatibility. So this is so that if new hardware support gets added in 12.10, you can still use it on the long-term support release and still have the long-term support, even though it's not a long-term support release that it was written for.
Exactly. Presumably. I mean, this is the perpetual problem you have with pressing a CD. You know, the same thing happens with, like, when my laptop came out. If you put a Windows XP CD in, it can't find the Serial 88 hard drive.
Yeah.
You know, and so we press 12.04.1 in August, which is updated, but we don't bundle in. You know, we historically never used to bundle in a newer kernel. So now we're giving the option for people to run a newer kernel. So in 2 years' time, when 12.04 is still an LTS and still a perfectly valid release to use, and someone goes out and buys a server that's got some funky new technology that's only supported in the 4.0 Linux kernel or whatever it will be by then, they can still do it with one of these newer kernels, but still on a supported LTS release. I think it's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah.
Mark Shuttleworth has had a online chat on The Register today.
Yeah,
in fact.
3 o'clock.
Yes,
it was.
I had a look at the. I didn't see at the time because I was busy working for Mark Shuttleworth.
You mean you don't get time off to watch your boss's online chat sessions?
No, some people do, John O'Bacon, I don't. It's quite interesting, actually. There's all the usual questions about, you know, why is Unity rubbish? And are you spreading yourself too thin, making tablets and all this kind of stuff? But I think Mark, you know, defended his position quite well. I haven't read the whole thing. I had a skim through some of it. But some of his comments about things like Linux Mint and GNOME 2 and the target demographic of GNOME 2 and Mint, you know, and the potential longevity of those things certainly struck a chord with me.
There was a really interesting point he made about the people he wants Ubuntu to target, which is that he said that that Windows people are always going to find Windows easiest and Mac people are always going to find Mac easiest, but he wants Windows people to find Ubuntu easier than the Mac and Mac people to find find Ubuntu easier than Windows.
Right.
So it means that if they were going to move anywhere, they would always move to Ubuntu.
Nice. Cool.
And finally, in the bit about Ubuntu, Asus are to start shipping Ubuntu-powered netbooks again.
Yes.
Netbooks is in inverted commas there. Why is that?
Well, you know, traditionally netbooks are small, underpowered and rubbish.
Like this thing balancing on my knee.
Yes, and like the thing over there playing these random audio files into the show. But this one's a little bit bigger and it's a little bit beefier.
It's like 11 and a half inches.
Yeah.
Which is a laptop as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, as I understood it, the reason why netbooks were all small screen 1.6 gigahertz Atoms was because in order to get the Windows not necessarily certification, but to get Windows Starter Edition license from Microsoft,
yes,
they impose restrictions on what you can put in a netbook.
Oh, really?
So that's why all the netbooks are exactly the same.
Mm.
It's because Microsoft wouldn't license the full version of Windows 7 because they know full well it wouldn't work very well. So they gave you the OEMs edition. The starter edition,
yeah,
but impose a limitation that it can't be any bigger than this screen size, can't allow more than this amount of RAM, and that kind of stuff. Whereas this one doesn't have those restrictions
because it's running Ubuntu.
Shipping Ubuntu. Plus also the kind of netbook market has kind of disappeared now and everyone's looking at tablets. But there are two netbooks in this room currently being used, so
yeah.
There is still some use for them.
Mm.
And that's it for the bit about Ubuntu.
But in the not about Ubuntu,
everyone's favourite Red Hat ARM person, John Masters, has demonstrated the low power requirements of an ARM server by powering one with a bicycle.
So he had it hooked up to a dynamo and was pedalling and got it to boot and run software.
Furiously, yes. He said he's put some... it was at a Red Hat conference.
Right.
Like a Red Hat summit, kind of the equivalent of UDS kind of thing.
Okay.
And he was up on stage demoing their Calzada server that you will have seen at previous...
Oh, this is summits. The massively hyperscale...
Yes.
It's like thousands of things in a box.
I think 96.
96.
But yeah, thousands. We'll also say thousands. Yeah. It sounds better. One of those on stage, and all kinds of wiring and various equipment to convert his kinetic movement into enough power to power.
So this wasn't server. This wasn't a single ARM machine he was powering. He was powering the whole thing.
I'm not entirely sure. I think actually what he was doing was charging a battery that was running.
Okay. Even so.
But still, you know.
Yeah, he's charging it proves the point.
Yeah, it does.
It doesn't need a lot of power.
It's a bit of a promo gimmick, but it's quite a nice thing to show, you know, the low power of ARM kit. Well done to him. And that's it for the bit about Ubuntu and not about Ubuntu for this week.
Now, on the last show, 2 weeks ago, we launched a competition to win a Raspberry Pi.
A brand new unboxed... Boxed.
Unboxed
is the word I meant. Yes.
So we just thought we'd thank everyone for the entries that have been sent in so far.
Yeah.
And just remind everyone of the details of the competition, which closes the day before the next show, which is the 16th of July?
That's right, yes.
So if you would like to win your very own Raspberry Pi... Answer us this question. What would you do with it?
Mm. And we'll collate all the answers, review them before the next show, and via some scientific method that's as yet been defined, we will decide who will win it.
And if you want to enter, you should email the answer to that question, that's what would you do with it, to competition@podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And that's all for the show. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of our show and give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday, the 17th of July, for our next live episode.
Wow, that was all works.
Not doing so this every are we doing time. It again here next time?
No. I'm going to burn all this equipment. We're never doing it again. We're going back to Tony's house. Done.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.